D-Day Plus 70, Return of the Liberators. Published in Legion Magazine. Written and narrated by Sharon Adams.
More than once, Bud Hannum is mobbed by children during celebrations of the 70th anniversary of D-Day and the Battle of Normandy in June of 2014. At ceremonies, mothers nudge their shy sons and daughters forward to speak with the Canadian war veteran, and he takes them into his arms and his heart. But one timid little girl of about 8 astonishes him. She asks, "May I touch you?" And when he hugs her, she triumphantly cries, "I touched a liberator. What a thing to tell my grandchildren." This sense of being part of history is something I've noted before among children in France, Belgium, and the Netherlands, who are carefully schooled in commemoration and flock to aged veterans, liberators of the towns and villages where their families are rooted. To them, these aren't dusty historical figures. They're the men who saved the lives of their parents and grandparents. Such living links to history are disappearing as veterans of the Second World War age. Most are in their 90s, and so there is a poignancy to ceremonies honoring those who survived the 1944 landings and the campaign that followed. Few of them will be able to return for the 75th anniversary. There is urgency, too, among witnesses who often appear to be on a quest to speak with veterans and capture their memories, moments that could be shared among succeeding generations. During the ceremony at Bretteville-sur-Lez Canadian War Cemetery, 100-year-old veteran Ernest Côté asks, "How does one maintain peace and freedom? That is the challenge of peacetime." Christophe Collette, a high school teacher from Caen, who helped arrange accommodations for some of the Canadian veterans, took up that challenge in 2006. He founded Association Westlake Brothers Souvenir, named after three Toronto brothers, George, Tommy, and Albert, who died in combat in June 1944. The association promotes remembrance, particularly among youth. This spring, Collette discovered that extremists had targeted youth with internet propaganda that misrepresents history, denigrates Allied forces, and denies the Holocaust. The association lodged a complaint against one writer for denial of crimes against humanity, an offense under French law, and a second complaint for illegal use of association images. Six other plaintiffs joined in, including a rural municipality and a village where Canadian troops fought. If they win their case, the writer could face imprisonment. The attack could be dismissed as an isolated incident by a crackpot, but in Collette's words, "It's a matter of principle. We could continue as if nothing had happened. But then our struggle for memory means nothing. We tell our young people that peace, freedom, and democracy are never free. This attack reminds us to accept the fight." 70 years after we thought Nazism was vanquished, there is another battle. The law is one means to address the problem. Preserving history is another. The incident underlines why, even after 70 years, it is still important to hear the words of people who lived history. Hannum agrees. "Don't be afraid to teach the children what went on, why we went to war. History," he says, "is the only defense against those who twist the truth." "The Allies liberated the people of Europe from 4 years of servitude," said Côté. "The people knew what it was to be incarcerated. And they are still generous with their gratitude. Aside from official ceremonies attended by royalty and heads of nations, Canadian veterans were feted in small Norman towns and villages. Many veterans who made the trip were hosted by local families and treated as treasured guests." Hannum was a guest of honor at a ceremony in Bali, about 8 kilometers from Juno Beach. A medic with the 23rd Field Ambulance, Hannum arrived on D-Day as Le Régiment de la Chaulière liberated the town. He worked in the casualty clearing station as Canadian troops battled their way inland. Occasionally, Hannum found himself treating civilians. The civilians never forgot. On his latest tour of Normandy, Hannum attended official commemorations and even spoke with the Prince of Wales during a major ceremony at the Juno Beach Center. But in the village of Bali, it's personal. Champagne and cherries from neighboring trees are savored at a reception where Hannum is reintroduced to Alfred Le Boucher and Yvonne Bazin, Labouche remembers Hannum helping him after his leg was blown off, while Bazine recalls how her little sister, Emilienne, died in Hannum's arms after she and her sister were strafed by a German plane. Today, a children's library sits where the aid station used to be, and it carries Hannum's name, an honor he accepted on behalf of all the troops who came here. He tells me, "I don't think I did anything more than anybody else. We have to have something real to remind the children of the price of freedom, and it has to be something solid." While Hannum is singled out for his actions during the war, he is one of many veterans that week sharing memories from the Battle of Normandy. In graveyards, after solemn ceremonies, on street corners, in cafes, whenever one of these soldiers, sailors, airmen, medics, engineers, or paratroopers begins to speak, a crowd quickly gathers, and their words are punctuated by the sounds of cameras and smartphones preserving the memories. Veterans John Ross of Lethbridge, Alberta, and Mervyn Jones of Ottawa are members of the 1st Canadian Parachute Battalion. They were among 543 Canadians dropped by parachute or glider behind enemy lines during the very early hours of D-Day. Ross remembers, "We were scattered badly. The first job was to clear the drop zone of any enemy, a job made difficult when their presence was announced by the bombing of gun emplacements." He adds, "We had a fight all night. After clearing a German strong point at Verraville and helping to march prisoners to Le Menil Crossroads, Ross and other paratroopers spent about 2.5 months on the important duty of preventing the enemy from retaking the ridge." He said, "If the Germans ever got that, they could fire down on incoming troops." Jones has often confided his thoughts upon landing. "I said to myself, Mervyn, I don't think you'll see your 22nd birthday." But 70 years later, he and Ross were there to watch 50 Canadian Army parachutists, part of an international contingent from France, the United Kingdom, and the United States, jump in tribute of the 1st Canadian Parachute Battalion, which suffered a casualty rate of more than 20% on D-Day. Also reminiscing during the anniversary was Bill Opitz of St. Albert, Alberta. He was lead stoker on His Majesty's Canadian ship Bayfield, one of the Canadian minesweepers whose duty it was to help clear the sea lanes for the invasion forces. The steam-powered ship used noise-reducing tactics like cutting mines loose from their cables to drift away rather than detonating them. The ship escaped notice despite coming within a kilometer of shore. Kenneth Bow, then 18, was on board HMCS Haida, protecting troop ships and patrolling for submarines. But many dangers remained for the 14,500 Canadians who landed on D-Day. Dennis Hubber of Penticton, B.C., was in the Royal Navy aboard a lucky landing craft. He said, "When the tide went out, on both sides of our big landing craft were these railway ties with mines on them. You could lean out and touch them." Other crafts did, and set off explosions. Then there were the machine guns. Roy Eddy, who served on the frigate HMCS Outremont, crewed a D-Day landing craft from which only 9 of 35 men got to shore alive. "There was blood 300 yards offshore," he said. "I've never gotten over it." Jack Hadley was in the Queen's Own Rifles assault wave, which faced murderous machine gun and mortar fire at Bernier-sur-Mer, as tanks meant to provide protective fire were delayed. He recalls, "There was a ship shooting rockets over our heads like a barrage. It wasn't very effective. Many were killed or wounded within the first few minutes. There weren't many left in Baker Company after the first hour. There were only 19 of us at the next roll call." Edgar Bedard of Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, was with the Cameron Highlanders of Ottawa. He said, "We came in behind the Queen's Own Rifles. There were so many bodies on the ground, we had to stop until some were picked up." Elsley Fowles of Coquitlam, B.C., was with the 22nd Canadian Field Ambulance, which went in right behind the assault troops. He recalls, "We were going from one to the other, putting dressings on, laying out stretchers. What comes back to me are sad memories. You look out at the beach now, and where are all those young boys? They're gone." His unit was a moving hospital. He said, "We followed the front lines maybe half a mile behind. We spent the whole war doing that." In the air witnessing the assault was Flying Officer Richard Romer, then just 20. He spoke at the official ceremonies of the pall of battle and constant shelling, of an awesome mile-wide column of ships stretching to the horizon, and the awful sight of troops disgorging from landing craft and being mowed down. Eventually, the pillboxes and gun emplacements were silenced. "I was lucky," explained Jack Hadley. "Survivors from his platoon made it off the beach and through a hole in the wall. I set up a Bren gun and was giving covering fire. At one point, I saw a slit trench about 100 yards inland with Germans poking their heads up. I fired in a couple of rounds and the whole gun crew came out with their hands up." After the beachhead was established, more troops and supplies arrived. Among them was Alan Canavan, now 93. He served with the 17th Duke of York's Royal Canadian Hussars, 7th Reconnaissance Regiment. He recalls, "They thought that 85% of us would be knocked out. Fortunately, that was erroneous." His unit sussed out enemy activities, intelligence used as the Allies battled across Normandy and beyond. Canavan and Eddy were among eight Canadians awarded the French Legion of Honor at a ceremony in Caen this year. Hannum was among those awarded the honor at other times. The Queen's Own Rifles lost 143 killed and wounded on D-Day. Says Hadley, "I lost a lot of friends that day." He lost more later at Le Mesnil-Patrie, where rifles met fanatical resistance from SS troops, and more still at Carpiquet Airport, where Hadley himself was wounded by shrapnel. He had to make his way to a medical aid post, jumping from slit trench to slit trench. "I had a feeling those buggers were aiming at me." Bedard also had a close call while sheltering in a slit trench during night bombing at Carpiquet. The next morning, an anti-personnel mine sat on the lip of his trench. "I could have touched it by accident in the night and it would have blown up. I was not even 20. I was scared. I was not brave. What a feeling I had." An engineer was called to cart the deadly thing away. Before he was wounded, Hadley watched the bombing of Caen. Hundreds of aircraft. It was an awful noise. All Caen was on fire. This was the first mission for Gunner Fraser Muir of Wasaga Beach, Ontario, part of a trainee flight crew tasked with dropping small bits of foil to confound enemy radar during the bombing of Caen. He went on to complete 35 bombing missions before the war ended. "We had to go through Caen the next morning, and it wasn't pleasant," said Art Boone of Stratford, Ontario, who was with the 19th Army Field Regiment. "The streets were filled with debris. Buildings were caved in. The enemy could be behind any corner." Adds artillery gunner John Comerford of Ottawa, "You could hardly make your way through the rubble." By August 10, 1944, German forces began fleeing eastward, but the Allies were intent on stopping them. "They were pouring everything at them in the Falaise Gap, so we were continually hauling up," recalled Jim Warford of Burlington, Ontario, who helped deliver ammunition, fuel, and supplies to the front line, wherever it moved. "At one stage, we hadn't had any sleep for well over 24 hours. Whenever the supply convoy stopped, we'd have to go along beside the lorries and bang on the doors because the men were falling asleep at the wheel." Boone remembers growing exhausted. "I was only 18 and in good physical shape, but I was really tired. We had 2 days' rest out of the 56 days before we broke out. We were shorthanded all the time." Falaise, remembers Boone, was a hard fight, both on the ground and in the air. "We were supporting the Polish, and they took an awful beating. We were on the top of a hill near Trun. In the valley, the Germans were sitting ducks. We annihilated them." His memories are of dead bodies, dead animals. The stench was horrible. Falaise marked the end of the Battle of Normandy, a 10-week campaign that claimed more than 18,000 Canadian casualties, including more than 5,000 killed. Hannum was at Falaise in mid-August, trapped under heavy gunfire. "I was on my hands and knees and said, 'God, get me out of here, and I'll be a better man.'" He was knocked unconscious for about 4 days, lost most of his hearing, and was wounded in the arm. "But he got me out," said Hannum. Passing along his memories helps fulfill his part of that bargain. "I've learned to tell the truth," he said, "even if it hurts. People need to know what happens in war. You see what high explosives do to the human body. Men can just disintegrate, and they're on the missing list, or they lose their arms, or their legs, or their minds. It's terrible." On their final night in France in 2014, Hannum, Eddy, Muir, and Alex Polowin of Ottawa, who served on HMCS Huron, are guests at a barbecue in the home of François Frimoux. It is an evening of good food, wine, music, and stories shared among three dozen guests. Colette speaks for the group. "We want to thank the liberators," he said, "both for what they did in 1944 and for returning 70 years later. We wish to meet each other and know each other. The message is, we're all family."
D-Day Plus 70, Return of the Liberators. Published in the September-October 2014 issue of Legion magazine. Written and narrated by Sharon Adams. Music, Beautiful Today, by Samantha Mouchet. Produced, mixed, and engineered by Michael Goyette. Executive Producer, Canvet Publications Limited.
There's an old man painting dreams by the water. He's painting life like he's almost afraid. It dies as the light goes away.